Bleiben Sie aktiv und zusammen mit uns nah am Marktgeschehen. Alle Episoden finden Sie auf www.chartered-investment.com/podcast.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to today's episode of Funds in 15 Minutes.
This time with Stefan Dreyer. Stefan is Managing Director of ANA, and we have a very particular topic today, which is tokenized funds need names, ISIN, DTI, and the standards layer. Welcome, Stefan. Very, very appreciated that you're my guest today. Welcome.
Good to be here with you.
Lovely. So without any further ado, due to our listeners know that Funds in 50 Minutes jumps right into the topics, I would already have one of the questions in mind to pose, which is if you had to explain the role of ANA to a fund manager in 1 minute, what would you say and why do identifiers matter beyond regulatory compliance?
Yeah, so I think the first key point is ANA. It's in the name, the Association of National Numbering Agencies. So we are an association sitting at the center of the Global Securities Identification System. And our members, the National Numbering Agencies, they allocate and govern ISINs, so International Security Identification Numbers, which are unique identifiers used to recognize financial and referential instruments around the globe. So for a fund manager, I think the simplest way to think about it is that ISINs are that common language of capital markets, that thread running through the ecosystem where every participant, whether you're a distributor, a trading venue, a custodian, regulator, data provider, you know exactly what you're talking about, the same instrument, given that that ISIN uniquely identifies that instrument. And so while regulation often drives adoption, I think the real value is the operational piece. So identifiers, they reduce that ambiguity that you have with naming conventions. They prevent costly reconciliation errors, and they enable automation of data processing across trading, settlement, reporting, and different risk systems. So from ANA perspective, it's not just about the compliance. They're a key part of the infrastructure allowing markets to scale safely and efficiently.
Well, that was a very, very particular explanation. Many thanks, Stefan. So you've already indicated it slightly, which leads to my second question, which is more or less essential for most of our listeners from the fund industry, which is why is an ISIN from your perspective for a fund share class more than, as I said, just a number? And how does it support downstream processes such as distribution, reporting, and risk management?
Yeah, sure. So an ISIN for a fund share class is really uniquely identifying and representing a precise economic instrument. And we know that, you know, funds can be issued in different ways with different share classes, different currencies, fee structures, dividend policies, different distribution channels. So having that globally recognized identifier ensures that those distinctions are preserved throughout that market infrastructure. And I think it's also important to highlight that the ISIN is not just the code, but there is a set of reference data that is associated with that ISIN that it transports. So once it's allocated, that ISIN becomes that kind of anchor reference across the entire lifecycle of the product. So we can be sure, again, that that issue around ambiguity when we're talking about a particular fund or fund share class, that we know specifically which one it is. So distributors ensure that investors subscribe to the correct share class. Custodians can use it to track the holdings. Regulators can use it for reporting. And risk systems use it to aggregate exposures. So without that standard identifier, those downstream processes, they rely on names or codes or other internal codes, which other counterparties may not be aware of. And therefore, that introduces that ambiguity and operational risk. And I think the interesting thing about funds is you're not just talking about the fund as an asset, but you have the assets within the fund, which are then also uniquely identified by the ISIN. So the ISIN is really that kind of key that connects everything together for the operational and analytical processes across that investment ecosystem.
Oh, that's a lovely, you know, comprehensive view on the I would call it the traditional capital markets. as you're well acquainted with it, and as it is on Vogue and in the news all over, everybody knows that fund units or share classes, et cetera, become more tokenized. So moving on to the, let's say, decentralized finance stage, when should the existing ISIN then remain the anchor of identity? And when do additional identifiers come into play, considering tokenization?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Tokenization is a key topic. And I think following kind of a surge of tokenization of debt instruments, funds became kind of the big new use case for the tokenization. So issuing the funds on blockchain, or, you know, the converse of that, where you have funds which invest in crypto assets, is the other element. But the simple answer to your question, ISIN should always continue to be used for that identity, because that's at the asset level. And from, you know, the ante position, tokenization doesn't change the economics of the instrument itself, right? It's still a fund. It really just changes the technology which is used to represent or transfer it. So when a token simply represents an existing fund share class, that original ISIN still remains that anchor of identity, as we phrased it. So the continuity is critical, because ISIN already links the instrument to the market infrastructure, regulatory reporting, and risk aggregation. And you will have funds in your portfolio that are not tokenized, and you might have funds that are tokenized, and you're still going to want to be able to use the same systems and infrastructure for both of those and not have to work in different environments. So that being said, there are additional nuances when you have assets which are issued or deployed onto DLT networks, so that tokenization. And there you have perhaps a use case for additional identifiers to describe that digital representation or that trading environment. And so a lot of work was done within the ISO standards community to develop a particular standard for that, which is the digital token identifier. And that was born with the view in mind that it interacts in a complementary way with the ISIN. So if you have a token which represents the asset, the fund, or potentially we have seen circumstances where you have an asset represented on multiple distributed ledgers, so therefore you would have multiple tokens, each uniquely identified, or if the token exists on a ledger where derivatives reference to it, then that DTI identifier and other market standards can capture those additional characteristics, particularly where you've got now an issue of technology risk that you may want to manage. So, you know, simply the ISIN identifies the instrument, the DTI identifies the tokens that represent that instrument or that asset, and the digital implementation around that.
Okay, understood. So let's jump in a little deeper on that particular topic. So in simple terms, so to say, how do then ISINs, the DTIs you just mentioned, and concepts such as XT ISINs, you can explain for our listeners a little bit further on that one, work together all in all, and what kind of practical problems are there? Are they actually designed to solve for market participants making use of them?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think the key differentiation is what I mentioned previously, is that the identifiers, they operate at kind of different but complementary layers. So the ISIN, if we're talking about funds, identifies the specific fund share class itself, whereas the DTI, which, by the way, is governed by the DTI Foundation, identifies the digital tokens used in DLT environments, particularly when those tokens function as tradable instruments or derivatives of tradable instruments. So the way that I would say it is the asset level and the token level, which are distinct layers. And again, as I mentioned before, the identifiers, it's not just the number itself, but there's a set of reference data that is associated with that. And that reference data is also unique to the identifier. So for ISIN, you have reference data such as the economic attributes of the asset. Who's the fund manager? What is the currency? Is it, you know, dividend information. You've got information about the CFI, so the classification of financial instruments, identifying what type of asset that is. Whereas with the DTI, it's kind of like if you've got a navigation system, your geo coordinates, right? It's telling you exactly on which chain the hashtag, all of that unique location data. So marrying those two things together, you've got what is it and where is it? Mm-hmm. And then we did some work within Anna over the last couple of years, looking at kind of the non-financial instrument side, where we have lots of cryptocurrencies, stable coins, and the like. And that is where the XT ISIN came. So really expanding the scope of coverage of ISIN beyond financial instruments to tokenized referential instruments, such as the e-money tokens or asset reference tokens. So when you see an XT ISIN, which, by the way, many funds invest in, so they'll become the underlyings in those funds, which you will want to be able to aggregate risk and exposure against, then you have that, again, that complete view. So the XT ISINs, they're really designed to bridge that traditional and digital world by linking the establishment or the established ISIN administrator with this tokenized representation. And so these standards, you know, we talk about what is the use case and what kind of problems are they solving. So it's really ensuring that market participants can consistently and uniquely identify and map instruments across traditional systems and blockchain environments. So if you don't have that kind of mapping and the ability to link those things together, you've got fragmentation, ambiguity, as I mentioned before. And so you have the same asset appearing under different names, multiple tokens, multiple formats. So how do you create that whole view? And maybe just a plug here, we also work very closely with GLIFE, which is a Global Legal Entity Identifier Foundation, where we have the legal entity identifier. So that's really the issuer level. And so between the three identifiers, LEI, ISIN, and DTI, you've got a hierarchical standard solution for looking at assets and their deployment across blockchain. So we get the transparency, we preserve the transparency that exists, we enable interoperability as the financial markets evolve and utilize the DLT more and more.
Oh man, Steven, thanks very much for that real great insight into exactly that. I wouldn't call it commingling, but in the combination and the entire conceptual working together of ISINs, DDIs, and the further concepts such as XT ISINs. That's lovely. Let's put it further into a little bit of a bigger picture when it comes to risks and tokenization. So what is your opinion on what operational market risk could arise if tokenization as of now scales without such robust standards like identifier mapping and governance, particularly in multi-chain or so-called wrapped token scenarios?
Yeah. So again, I'll reiterate that fragmentation of identity is one of the biggest risks if you don't have the standards there. Obviously, you don't necessarily have the efficiency, because then you're having to figure out how to marry traditional systems with other systems which are using infrastructure to support the digital side of things. And you have a risk of losing the transparency and being able to understand assets that may exist on both sides of the, either in traditional form and digital form simultaneously. So the same underlying asset, again, we know can be deployed on different blockchains for different reasons, whether it's to create liquidity or reduce the technological risk, but also across different custodial platforms or exchanges. And we know, exchanges are big users of the standards. When you have assets which are listed on multiple venues, being able to identify that you're talking about the same asset, even though the price on the venue may be different. And then the wrap structures, you know, different naming conventions. Obviously, a lot of fund names tend to be very, very long to try and be as descriptive as possible, but not all systems are configured to accommodate that. And so you get this model of abbreviation, and then they all start looking the same, and the ability to distinguish between those. And you know, I'm sure it makes it's very important both to or to investors to understand, you know, is it USD? Is it Euro? Is it, you know, NAVs, INAVs, distributions or no distributions type thing, to be able to make that differentiation, which may be captured in there. So again, taking the identifier creates that uniqueness that says, yes, we're talking about the same thing, even though the name might be slightly different. And then I have the associated reference data to be able to validate that. So it's about, you know, understanding and market participants being able to understand that two tokens represent the same underlying instrument. Because if they can't, that creates operational risks in reconciliation and settlement and valuation, regulatory reporting, which are all cost burdens for market participants and the industry. So that efficiency helping to reduce that. And it also reduces or introduces risk aggregation challenges if you don't have those standards, because you may unknowingly hold exposures to the same underlying asset in different tokenized forms. So that, I think, is the big use case. When we think about wrapped kind of tokens, I think we have examples certainly on the crypto side where you've got Bitcoin and wrapped Bitcoin, which are not the same thing. Or more recently, we've seen the introduction of tokenized equity. There's a lot of noise and activity around that, but you have different types of tokenized equity, right? So you've got the kind of issuer sponsored, which is really the stock itself with all of the rights that go with it. You have a model in between that where there may be a tokenization of the underlying through some type of derivative, which is then wrapped in a certificate form. And then the third model, which is kind of the synthetic equities, where you have some third party creating something that looks like the stock, but is not actually a stock, even if it is, it may have collateral behind it of the stock. So I think it's important for an investor to be able to distinguish between those and not just say stock X on the label, thinking it's all the same thing, because you've got a huge risk there. So, you know, from my perspective, Anna's perspective, those robust identifiers and governance, they're essential because they create that single authoritative identity for financial and referential instruments, even if the technological representations multiply.
Yeah, understood, understood. Very well explained. Many, many thanks, Stefan. We're running a little bit out of time, but there wouldn't be any podcast episode of Funds in 15 Minutes without a little bit of crystal balling and looking into the future. So last but not least, your 1 to 2 sentence answer on looking ahead in a year, what would be one clear signal that tokenized funds have moved from mere experimentation, what we see at the moment, to business as usual? And from your and Anna perspective, what role do standards play in such an enabling of the transition?
Yeah, absolutely. Keeping it short, I mean, I think it's when you have that seamless integration into the existing market infrastructure, and it's really just another form of fund issuance and distribution. And we don't have to talk about tokenized versus non-tokenized, right? Where the technology doesn't matter anymore. I think that's a very clear signal that we've moved into a new framework, the same way that we don't talk about bearer and registered or paper and physical anymore. So it's just the next step in that evolution. And I think standards play a decisive role in that transition. Again, for all the reasons mentioned and the benefits that they bring, and they help ensure that, you know, innovation can scale without breaking, you know, interoperability and trust that the global capital markets need.
Lovely. Ladies and gentlemen, this was another episode of Funds in 15 Minutes with Stefan Dreyer of Anna. Many thanks, Stefan, for being my guest. Enjoyed it very much.
You're very welcome. My pleasure.
Thanks.
Dieser Podcast dient ausschließlich Informationszwecken. Die besprochenen Inhalte stellen weder eine Anlageberatung noch eine Empfehlung oder ein Angebot zum Kauf oder Verkauf von Fondsanteilen dar. Bitte treffen Sie Investitionsentscheidungen ausschließlich auf Basis offizieller Verkaufsunterlagen.